Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, as we scan across the world landscape, and whether our focus is on looming fresh water shortages or maybe ocean acidification from CO2 in the atmosphere or the vast consequences of picking over the dregs of the fossil fuel revolution as we scrape off mountaintops or frack enormously long wells for relative peanuts per well of eventual production, one thing is clear. The fossil fuel energy predicament is severe. And you know what? The growing global geopolitical tensions are another sign of that as well. Now, back in 2012, we had on this program Kirk Sorensen, a proponent of a new type of energy production, I should say, that could remedy many of the issues on that dire opening list. That energy source would come from the use of thorium, a mildly radioactive and very abundant element. Now, as I've said at many points in my writing and my presentations, my book, heck, every chance I get, we don't need any new technologies to be discovered. There are solutions already on the shelf that we simply have to get serious about using. Today, we are again talking with Kirk about the liquid fluoride thorium reactors, or LFTR, or LFTR technology. He is a co-founder of FLIBE, F-L-I-B-E, which is an acronym, I think, from fluorine and lithium and beryllium. FLIBE Energy is dedicated to developing a thorium-based reactor. Welcome back, Kirk.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Happy to be back.
Great. Now, we've linked to the prior podcast that you and I had for a deeper background into the thorium technology for those interested, but just to set the stage, briefly tell us, what is the thorium fuel cycle and how is this reactor technology proposed to work?
Okay, great question. The kind of reactors we use today, we're burning a small amount of natural uranium called uranium-235, and it's naturally fissile. In other words, you just hit it with one neutron and it's going to release energy. The main difference between what we're proposing and the kind of reactors we use today is it takes two neutrons to release the energy from thorium. One neutron converts the thorium into another isotope called uranium-233, and the next one fissions it. And fortunately, in the release of energy, it also releases enough energy or enough neutrons to keep this cycle going. And so it's sometimes referred to as a breeder reactor or a breeding cycle. The advantage here is that once the reactor is started with a small amount of fissile material, and this can come from any of a number of different sources, the reactor then just consumes this abundant natural thorium, which is about three times more common than uranium. It is a basically different process than what we do today, and much more sustainable, not just because thorium is so much more abundant, but because of the efficiency at which the thorium has to be utilized in the reactor. And so that really separates it. In addition, the thorium technology is best realized when it's used in what's called a molten salt reactor, which uses salts of lithium and beryllium as the solvent or the basis in which the nuclear reaction takes place. And these type of reactors, which were demonstrated in the 1960s at Oak Ridge National Labs in Tennessee, they have superior safety and performance advantages. They run at high temperature, which is good, but low pressure, which is also very good, and they're very easy to refuel and to purify. But the research was discontinued in the early 70s because of competition with a fast breeder reactor program that was favored in the U.S. and has really languished ever since.
Well, you know, one of the criticisms that was leveled in response to the first podcast that you and I did was people will come up and say, you know, there's never been a commercially viable design of a thorium reactor. It's never happened. Therefore, there must be something wrong with it.
Well, you know, having been a student of the history of technology, that's a criticism that's easy to level against any new idea. The first person to do it, obviously, is the first person to do it, and somebody didn't do it before. Everything I see shows that there's a very attractive business opportunity that's available out there by utilizing thorium as an energy resource. And it seems to be lining up, both the thorium and the molten salt reactor technology seem to be lining up with a lot of needs that we're facing this country. You touched on earlier in the beginning of the podcast about our never-ending need for more and more clean energy. we're also facing a lot of issues and situations in the nuclear space in our country regarding our nuclear fuel cycle, waste management, lack of enrichment capability, concerns about accident scenarios, all of which could be addressed and mitigated by this technology. So just because somebody hasn't demonstrated it before doesn't mean it can't be done. I'm an engineer. I look at the physics and the situation and the technology and make my assessment into whether it can be done or not.
Well, now, the truth is there were a couple, two operating thorium reactors for a period back there in the 60s, were there not?
Well, there have been two small molten salt reactors, one of which operated just for a short period of time in the 1950s. The other one operated much longer from 1965 to 1969. They were intended to begin to demonstrate the basic principles that would lead to a thorium reactor. They didn't use thorium in those reactors, but they were moving in that direction. There have also been several solid-fueled reactors that have used thorium. The Fort St. Vrain reactor, which was a gas-cooled reactor, used thorium in its fuel. So did the Indian Point reactor in New York, and its first fuel load used thorium. There was a demonstration of a thorium-uranium-233 fuel cycle done at the Shipping Port reactor in Pennsylvania. That was a light water reactor in the late 1970s. So none of these reactors individually represent the complete example of what I'm talking about, but all of them were pieces of the technology demonstration. And right now we have a situation where economically we have been able to be very wasteful with our uranium inventories and use only a tiny fraction, less than half of 1% of the energy contained in the uranium. But if we want to look in a future where we're going to rely on nuclear for far greater percentages of our energy supply, we have to be able to use nuclear fuel more efficiently than we're doing now.
Well, let's talk about that efficiency for a second. You might throw a few hundred tons of uranium into a reactor, get a gigawatt back out. How does thorium compare in terms of that overall amount of material needed and the amount of energy produced?
You know, it's something where it really is hard to make an apples-to-apples comparison, mm-hmm. because what we have today, we burn uranium-235. We burn this small amount of material out of a much larger mass of uranium. When you're talking about a thorium reactor, you, by definition, have to use the fuel more efficiently because it's a breeder reactor. You have to go and preserve that initial amount of fissile material you started the reactor with. And so it's not as if you can go from 1% to 10% or 20% or 50%. It's almost like you have to go from less than 1% efficiency in uranium to, you know, 90%+ efficiency in thorium. It's just the physics of how the machine runs. Because, as I mentioned at the beginning, thorium needs two neutrons to release its energy. And so that's how you have to make these machines run, so that they're always producing sufficient neutrons to keep the thorium consumption going.
Now, there's a very laborious, difficult process separating out that 235 from the far more abundant 238 matrix that uranium comes in. Is there any a similar process for thorium?
Well, there has to be an inventory of fission material with which the reactor is started, and that might be U-235, it might be uranium-233, of which a small amount exists in the U.S., and it might also be, if we decide to use it to destroy our plutonium inventory. So there are a lot of different options for starting it. But once the reactor has been started, it doesn't require that complicated enrichment process you just mentioned. And that's really important, because I don't think a lot of people realize the United States, although we developed the technology for uranium enrichment back in the 1940s, again at Oak Ridge, we have almost completely left the market in this area. There was a large facility at Paducah, Kentucky, where the United States enriched its uranium, and that was shut down last year. And there were several ideas of how to replace that enrichment capability with facilities in Ohio. And these really have come to an end. GE was going to use lasers to enrich, and that's come to an end. And I'm really worried, because we're still running 100 reactors in this country, more than any other country in the world, and they all require uranium enrichment, and yet we've essentially shut down most of our enrichment capability. Who's got most of the enrichment capability in the world? The Russians do. And you know, you have to cross your fingers that political situation is going to stay stable enough for us to import enriched uranium. Otherwise, we're just not going to have sufficient enrichment capability to keep our existing machines running. So it's yet another reason to go, let's look at a future technology where we're not going to need this enrichment.
Well, there was a big source as well, to deviate slightly, where it was the megatons to megawatts program, where we were using decommissioned warheads from Russia and feeding that reactive element of U-235 that we pulled from that into our reactors over here. So
that program has come to an end. Yeah, that program came to an end last year before all these new political tensions sort of flared up again. And it probably all for the best that it came to an end, because it probably would have been ended under the current situation we're in. So yes, the import and downblending of Russian highly enriched uranium was artificially acting like a bunch of enrichment capability. It was really enrichment that the Russians did decades ago that we were essentially, you know, using now. That's over. And so now we're really kind of facing the full force of the reality of our lack of preparation. And again, to me, it's another argument to go and say, okay, we can either, you know, build N enrichment plants and try to get on top of this again, or, you know, we can try to move towards technology that's not going to need it.
Well, what would we be enriching specifically? Because my understanding is the United States is well past peak of uranium production, and the remaining reserves that we might have are fairly low grade, but they're not, I don't know that they're enough to justify, at least from a private setting. If I'm a company and I'm looking at the landscape, I'm not sure I would look at the United States native sources of unenriched uranium ore and say, hey, that's enough to justify building one of these enormously expensive plants. Is that true, or have I missed something?
Well, you know, the United States pretty much always was importing uranium from other countries. We were importing it here, enriching it in uranium-235, and then exporting it to our own plants and to places around the world. And there's a lot of countries that rely on U.S.-sourced enriched uranium. For instance, I went to South Korea last year. They have an agreement where they get all of their enriched uranium from the United States. And then now I also went to United Arab Emirates, to Dubai, and they're building reactors there of South Korean origin, but still also relying on U.S. Enriched uranium supply. So it's not just our own country that we're threatening by dropping the ball on enrichment. It's South Korea and the UAE and probably others as well. So I sort of feel the pressure tightening on doing something about our nuclear situation, and looking out in the future, I go, well, you know, wouldn't it be better to try to get onto this thorium technology where we're not going to need this uranium enrichment to that degree? Obviously, we've still got 100 reactors, but, you know, trying to make a logical plan for the future.
All right, so let's talk about safety for a minute, because, you know, for anybody who's paying the slightest bit of attention, Fukushima just continues to, pardon the pun, but leak information out about just how bad that thing was. Recently, we discovered something that I was convinced of years ago, right when I saw the Reactor 3 explosion. TEPCO admitted that the primary containment vessel was breached and that the secondary containment vessel blew. And now they admit that they have found particles of that inner reactor core hundreds of kilometers, at least over 100 kilometers away. So that was a really exothermic reaction, rather dramatic. And so as we wander over into the idea of a thorium reactor, I've read some criticism that say, yeah, you know, it's producing stuff, but it still is producing U-232 as a byproduct, half-life 160,000 years, technetium-99 is in there, iodine-129, all of these with very long half-lives. Talk to us about the eventual waste that's produced and the risks that might be contained in that.
Yeah, and let's kind of have perspective here. I mean, first of all, nobody has been killed by the Fukushima accident. You know, it's something that I think is really milked by the news media because it stokes fear in people. But we have natural gas explosions, we have oil pipeline explosions, we have cars derailing, we have all these things going on all the time that are killing scores and scores and scores of people, and yet, you know, there's so much attention placed on Fukushima. I just really want to get it off my chest that I think it's just completely out of whack with the real risk level. That said, it's a bit of a not secret in the nuclear community that the reactor design used at Fukushima, a GE BWR Mark I, had a pretty sorry containment design on it. And you can find memos going all the way back to the early 70s saying, you know, there's a lot of ways this thing can go wrong. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, it did at Fukushima. And the thing that we have to remember in the United States is we have quite a few GE BWR Mark I's in our nuclear fleet. I think of our 100 reactors, about 30 of them are of that design.
Yeah, I live about 10 miles from one, 15.
And they don't have a particularly robust containment. And now we know, okay, you know, you turn off the emergency power and 4 days later you're going to get a hydrogen leak and potentially you could have a hydrogen explosion. Now there's ways to deal with that were not done by TEPCO. But nevertheless, The other thing to remember, too, is it's really, really easy to detect radionuclides that have gotten out somewhere. I mean, they're so tiny, but they're so easily detectable that we can detect amounts of material that are far, 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 far below the threshold that is going to cause us any risk. So when you say, we've found pieces of the core hundreds of kilometers away, I said, well, great, good for you. Does that pose any risk to the people that are there? You know, is it, or are you just sensationalizing the fact that you found something? And then going to the next point you made, every fission reaction is going to cause the creation of a certain family of materials. They're called the fission products. They include technetium-99. They include iodine-129. Some of these have half-lives measured in the hundreds of thousands of years. The radioactivity of something is inversely proportional to its half-life. So something that has a really long half-life has a really low radioactivity. So people don't think about it that way. They think, oh, this is going to be deadly for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. You want to go, no, actually, the longer the half-life, the less risky something is to you. In the event of a nuclear accident, the thing that is the most dangerous by far is iodine-131, which has a half-life of 8 days. Why is it dangerous? Because it has a half-life of 8 days. That means it's very radioactive, but it also means it's going away very quickly. The difference between the thorium approach that I'm advocating with the molten salt reactors, the LFTR concept, liquid fluoride thorium reactor, is that it doesn't produce long-lived transuranic waste. This is the stuff like plutonium, americium, curium, stuff that's formed when the fuel doesn't burn. It doesn't produce that long-lived waste. It does produce the fission products, but by and large, you'd be amazed how rapidly they decay away. You named off the one or two that don't decay away rapidly, namely iodine-129 and technetium-99. And to give you an idea how harmless technetium-99 is, people all around the world ingest a much more radioactive form of technetium-99 called technetium-99M that only has a 6-hour half-life. They do it for medical procedures, and then they simply excrete the technetium-99 into the water supply. So it's not a big deal. We have hospitals all around the world where people are intentionally ingesting this material and then just, you know, urinating it out to the municipal water supply. So technetium-99, not a big deal. Iodine-129, also not a big deal because of the long half-life. I read an analysis done by a friend of mine who's a health physics person. He said, you know, if you ingested nothing but iodine-129 till the day you die, it would still never even harm your thyroid. People, I think, get mixed up because they think of iodine-129 and they have heard about iodine-131, which has the 8-day half-life, and they go, uh-oh, you know, I've heard this iodine stuff is really bad. And you're like, well, iodine-131, yes, that is really bad, but iodine-129, harmless. It's not going to hurt you. So you've got to, I know I hate, I sound like I'm getting in the weeds here, but you got to kind of like see all these different pieces to understand the real risk going
on. Well, I'll tell you the risk that we focused on at my site. I wrote a fairly long report around radioactivity because I do think there's a lot there that needs to be clarified and there's a lot of misconceptions. Radioactivity itself doesn't concern me all that much. Particulate contamination does. I mean, it's the difference between taking polonium-210 and rubbing it all over your skin and you're fine, but ingesting a, you know, pinhead size of it and you're done, right? Because that has to do with the nature of the alpha particle itself. Very harmless on the outside, deadly on the inside, depending on the substance we're talking about. So what I care about with the Fukushima disaster is not the radioactivity per se, but it was the particulate contamination that can get released, because that stuff can be, I would not want to live in a particulately contaminated zone, personally, yeah. Right?
There's three things that came out of the Fukushima site that are really of concern. The first one was iodine-131, with its 8-day half-life, very dangerous. But it's also the easiest to mitigate against by taking potassium iodide. Basically, you flood your body with non-radioactive iodine. Iodine only has one isotope, naturally. It's iodine-127. Basically, you flood your body with iodine-127 and you don't ingest it. So you can mitigate against that. The two longer-term risks are cesium-134 and cesium-137. 134 has a 2-year half-life, 137 has a 30-year half-life. So the 134 is more radioactive, it's going away more quickly. The 137's got a longer half-life. Cesium tends to bind to things because it's an alkali metal, it essentially forms salts. It's a really chemically reactive substance like sodium or lithium. And that's really when they're going around and saying, oh, this site's contaminated by Fukushima, they're finding cesium. The iodine's all gone. Everything from Fukushima in terms of iodine is long since gone. Iodine-131 is all decayed away. There's not a speck of it left. But the cesium is going to be around for a while. So in the event of an accident, you really don't want a reactor design that is going to release cesium. Now, does the LFTR make cesium? Yeah, it makes a cesium just like the light water reactors do. The difference is In the fluoride salt, cesium is stable. In fact, it's incredibly stable. It's a stable salt called cesium fluoride. In oxide fuel, which is what we have in today's reactor, cesium is volatile. And that's why when you overheat oxide fuel, when you get a meltdown, the cesium becomes, it can be liberated to the environment, which is what happened at Fukushima. With the fuel that's used in a liquid fluoride reactor, you can take the fuel out and dump it on the ground outside, and the cesium's not going to get away because it's formed this super stable cesium fluoride salt. So you've got a chemical situation going on inside the reactor that is binding the most dangerous radionuclides from releasing, both cesium and strontium. Both form very, very stable salts in the lifter and don't want to volatilize or get out into the environment.
Well, let's say you had just mind game here. There was a lifter reactor in place at Fukushima and it loses all of its power. What happens?
It loses all of its power. There's a drain tank underneath the reactor, and the fuel inside the reactor, which is liquid, is kept from that drain tank by a frozen plug of salt. So you lose all the power. That frozen plug of salt melts. The fuel drains out of the reactor into the drain tank, freezes solid, and end of story. No further intervention required. What happens in a lifter is exactly the opposite of what happens in these solid-fueled reactors. They're solid-fueled. We don't want them to overheat because we don't want them to melt and release their fission products. The lifter, the fuel is already liquid, and it's liquid at higher temperatures. It freezes and holds up its fission products. So it's a completely different outcome. No intervention would have been required. No off-site radionuclide release.
Just a big tank of frozen salt that you have to figure out what to do with.
Big tank, well, what you do with it is you go thaw it, pump it back in the reactor, and turn the reactor back on.
Uh-huh.
And remember the Fukushima plant survived the earthquake. Mm-hmm. You know, they survived, and the earthquake was way beyond what they were designed for, but they survived the earthquake. The damage that occurred to the plants was the damage that occurred after the cooling system was lost. The fuel overheated, and that's what generated the damage to the reactor plants. So it's important to remember that the plants themselves survived the reactor accident very well.
Yeah, it was the loss of power, and that's actually honestly the thing that concerns me the most around our own plants here in the U.S. is that loss of power. Again, I mentioned I'm you know, as the crow flies, 10-15 miles from one of these GE designed plants. So what I'm concerned about, it was in 2012, apparently there was a Carrington class event that missed us by a week. Like if we were 1% further along in our orbital rotation around the sun, we would have been whacked by something pretty serious. And nobody knows what the effect of that could be, but just sake of argument, if there was a sustained 2-month loss of power in a region of the country as a consequence, that could be a very difficult situation because you know, those plants need to be continually cooled, and if they lose power, then you need your diesel backup generators to run. If you lose power in a sustained way in a region, you might run out of diesel fuel, or the diesel generators might have got whacked too. That to me was like an unacceptable risk, and I'm not comforted that we don't seem to have a solid plan in place in this country that says, here's how we would deal with a sustained outage caused by one of these coronal mass ejections, which sounds like one of these wacky things, but you know, we had one in 1859, and apparently we missed one that was even more intense than that, you know, in 2012 by a 1% rotational turn of chance in our orbital cycle.
To be honest, Chris, if we have a Carrington event, nuclear power is the least of our problems. We got so much bigger. We're going to be so much more in trouble from the Carrington event than that. But hey, I hear you. I live 20 miles away from three BWR Mark I's at the Browns Ferry plant right on the banks of the Tennessee River. They are the three plants in this country that are the most similar to Fukushima. They were built at the same time by the same company, have the same design. So, and I'm 20 miles almost due east of them. So I know that if something, you know, I really hope that TVA is staying on top of all their safety with that. And the thing to do is to move towards designs eventually that don't have these limitations. And I think the lifter is an example of one of these designs. There's others as well. A new scale is working on a reactor that has a tremendous amount of inherent safety. A lot of other people are as well. I like the lifter because the safety that you can build in doesn't compromise the performance or the price. It actually works right hand in hand with it. And also remember, you know, when people were building these GE Mark I's back in the 70s, you know, they didn't think they were going to be running them for 40 or 60 years. They figured, you know, you're probably running these for 30 years and you replace them with something way better than that. So a lot of the decisions that were made 30, 40 years ago were made in an environment where they didn't anticipate we would do all the dumb things that we actually did.
And, yeah. Yeah, well, I agree that we will have very large problems if a Carrington event comes, but I would hate to have a melting meltdown reactor as an addition to that. I would feel better if I wasn't around these particular reactors that are here.
One of the good sides about the Fukushima incident is the mitigations to protect these Mark I's are not particularly complicated. You know, number one, don't knock out your diesels. You know, number two, keep your diesels fueled. As long as you circulate the water through the core after shutdown, everything can be fine. Remember, when the tsunami hit Fukushima, the reactors had already been shut down for an hour, and they'd been cooling for an hour. And believe it or not, that first hour is the most important hour when it comes to cooling. You lose most of your fission product inventory is decays away in that very first hour after shutdown. So, you know, what happened in Japan was a once-in-a-thousand-year event that was compounded by a really dumb design of putting diesel generators in the basement. You know, go to your local plant and say, where are your diesels? Do you have them on the roof or something like that? You know, that'd be a lot better.
Absolutely. All right, so I like the idea of safety, but let's talk about maybe bringing this into reality. Now, the last time we talked, you said that the Chinese were starting what appeared to be an aggressive program of research and development on a thorium reactor. They had hired a bunch of PhDs, maybe numbering over 100. There was funding involved, and you'd mentioned that they had a plan, which sounded aggressive, of having a pilot developed by 2020, if I recall the stories correctly. What can you give us as an update on their efforts?
Oh, yeah, I can give you a great update because I was at a conference in Nashville just 2 weeks ago, and one of the representatives from Chinese Academy of Sciences was there, and he gave a presentation, showed us where they were at, what was going on. It was really clear to me that they're making tremendous progress. You know, I saw pictures of test loops. I saw pictures of lithium separation cascades. I saw pumps and heat exchangers and fuels and all manner of things under development. So, yeah.
Pictures?
No, well, schematics and actual pictures. Whoa. But, I mean, it was clear to me what I was looking at was hundreds and hundreds of researchers at work and building stuff. Things really happening, things really going forward. It was pretty sobering, you know, and then here were several of us Americans in the room talking about what we would like to do, you know, what we would think about doing. And I have to admit, I was kind of upset that here we were chatting and yapping and there they were doing. So it is very much going forward and making impressive progress. Their latest schedule that I heard at this meeting was a small 2-megawatt thermal reactor by 2020 that wouldn't have a power conversion system, would essentially be, but that would still be the first molten salt reactor somebody's turned on since 1969. Turns out the Chinese actually had a molten salt reactor program in the early 70s, and they were unable to develop the proper nickel alloys to contain the molten salt, and so they shut the program down around 1976, not long after we did. We, on the other hand, had developed that nickel alloy and successfully demonstrated it at Oak Ridge during the molten salt reactor experiment. So I found it kind of interesting that it was that little technology advantage that allowed us to do it and then not to be able to do it. Now, of course, they've you know, kind of come in from the cold as far as technology exchange. They know what we did, and they showed a number of samples of various nickel alloys that they're developing for this program. So that's not a problem for them anymore. They've gotten past that challenge, and they see the advantages of using thorium in the molten salt reactor to be able to produce high temperature, you know, high quality heat for not just for electricity generation, but also for industrial processes, for hydrocarbon generation, desalination, a lot of different things. They're excited about it. They're going forward just essentially on all fronts with nuclear. They're going forward with light water reactors, fast breeder reactors, gas-cooled reactors, molten salt reactors. There's almost nothing that they're not doing in the nuclear space and putting serious resources on it. And again, I just can't help but contrast what we're not doing in the United States to what they're doing. It's pretty humbling.
Well, why are they doing that, do you think?
Because they've chosen to. You know, they've made a decision that we are going to treat this like a priority. We're going to go make it happen. And we in the U.S. haven't.
Is it because you think the Chinese see the energy landscape like I do, which is that fossil fuels are finite and becoming more difficult to come by. And
well, I know they see that, and you know, not only are they moving out aggressively with nuclear, but they're moving out aggressively trying to lay hands on fossil fuel resources all over the world. I mean, the Chinese aren't messing around with energy. I think they have internalized the message that energy is the master commodity. Mm-hmm. Everything else depends on energy. And if you don't have an energy supply that is reliable and sustainable, you're putting your entire nation at risk. We in the United States, I sometimes think we're cursed by abundance and options. We have so many things we could do that it makes it hard for us to decide what we will do. And we're just sleepwalking through this problem.
Well, we also have a bad habit of telling ourselves stories. I've run into politicians and thought leaders and corporate leaders and who all tell me very assuredly that fracking has completely, you know, eliminated peak oil. Guys, it delayed it by a small amount, but if you understand fracking at all, you know that too is a finite resource. Fracked oil is supposed to peak in the year 2019 to 2021, depending on who you believe, according to our own government. I mean, that's like tomorrow in the world of energy transitions.
Exactly. And what we've got now is you know, we should say our prayers every night in gratitude for fracked gas and fracked oil, because it has held off the day of reckoning. And if we were wise, we would be using this bounty to help us prepare for the next stage. But unfortunately, we're not wise.
No. So I was researching thorium a bit, and I found that Norway apparently has tried thorium, but in a conventional reactor. How does that work, and how's their experiment going?
Yeah, what they're doing in Norway is kind of analogous to what happened to that shipping port reactor that I mentioned earlier, where they're using solid oxide fuel like we use in today's reactors. They're loading it into water-cooled, you know, pressurized reactors and testing it out. And it's an example of where, you know, thorium can make a little bit of a difference, but it doesn't make that radical difference. And the reason why is because you're not really running the reactor as a breeder reactor. You're essentially replacing the we talked about the enrichment of uranium earlier. That's mm-hmm. when you change the percentage of the valuable U-235 to the less valuable 238. If you're not breeding, all you're doing with those kind of thorium reactors is you're replacing essentially worthless uranium-238 with worthless thorium. It makes a little difference. It stretches out the fuel cycle a little longer, but it's not a radical improvement. And so, you know, I know the guys that are working on this in Norway. We go to the same conferences. You know, we go to dinner when we're there. I say, hey, I love you guys, but, you know, I kind of think you're wasting your time. You know, yeah. And they're like, well, hey, Kurt, you know, you listen up. There's 100, you know, there's 400 reactors in the world that use fuel this way, and there's no reactors in the world that use fuel the way you're talking about. So we're going after those reactors. We're going after the ones that are built that need fuel now. And that's, you know, fine, guys, but, you know, uranium's cheap. And what I'm talking about is a radical change. It's an absolute step, you know, quantum step forward. And yeah, it's not in existence today. We don't have it today. That's not stopping me. You know, we've got to go and make it happen, because the path we're on now is not sustainable, both in a nuclear sense, you know, fossil fuels. Take your pick. We have got to get on sustainable energy paths. And that's why I feel so strongly about using thorium in the lifter, is that is a sustainable energy path. It's a path that if we develop the technology, we build the reactors, we're going to be able to keep that thing running for thousands, tens of thousands of years because of the abundance of the thorium and the lack of the need of the enrichment.
So that's a great point I probably should have brought up much earlier. Given the abundance of thorium, knowing what we know about the designs, given the fact that we're probably going to grow our energy use slightly, there is somewhere how much thorium is there in terms of years of energy production?
Alvin Weinberg did a calculation in 1959 based on the thorium in the crust of the Earth mined to a reasonable depth, assuming 7 billion people, which is about the world population right now, living at a Western standard, which we're not at now. But let's assume they're at a Western standard of energy consumption. His estimate of the thorium reserve was 30 billion years, which puts it at about six times longer than the sun has left. So, you know, I don't worry too much about, are we going to run out of thorium? And we also have convenient maps of thorium on the moon and Mars and asteroids. It's really, again, for the same reason it's easy to find Fukushima fragments far away from the site, it's easy to find thorium on other planets. It tells you it's there. So running out of thorium is not an issue. And the beauty of getting to the lifter technology, like I said before, there's not really an in-between going to this 0.5% energy efficiency and going, you know, to 90%+ energy efficiency. It's going to be a step function. it's going to be that kind of thing, because the technology does not lend itself to increment. You're going to go from not breeding to breeding, and it's just going to be absolutely revolutionary as far as energy consumption goes. It's a future I believe in so strongly. I'm working towards it, and I just want to sound the alarm. I don't mean to say alarm, but sound the alarm to the world that, hey, come on, let's wake up, guys. Let's go make this happen. Other people are doing it. The United States, who discovered every part of this, really, really ought to be at the forefront.
Well, absolutely. And let me talk about one other part of this. How about fresh water? Now, you know, coal plants, natural gas fired power plants, conventional nuclear plants all consume a large amount of fresh water in their thermal cycle. Is that part of the lifter technology too?
Well, every power conversion system has to reject the waste heat to the environment. And one of the things that a lot of these other plants have in common is they use steam turbines. And steam involves, you know, it's not very complicated. We've known about it for 200 years or so. You boil the steam at high pressure. You flow that steam through a turbine where it blows down, releases that pressure, turns the turbine. And then you've got to condense the steam back into water. And that's where you use a lot of that cooling water. It's not so that we consume it. We consume the coolth out of it. Coolth isn't the word. Warmth is a word, but coolth isn't. But that's really what we want out of the water. We don't want the water. We want the coolth out of the water. And using steam cycles and condensers, you put a lot of water through that system. Now, when you look at something like a lifter that runs at much higher temperatures, you have some different options for how to make electrical power. And one of the most attractive is to use gas turbines instead of steam turbines. So you can look at gas turbines. With gas turbines, now potentially you can air cool those systems rather than water cool those systems. And that gets me pretty excited, because I'm originally from the West, where it's pretty arid. You know, we don't have Tennessee rivers out there. Mm-hmm. And we also don't have big nuclear reactors, and same reason why. If you want to deploy nuclear energy to places where you don't have a lot of water resources, then you've really got to go to a high-temperature reactor that can use air cooling. It changes the game, and it makes nuclear accessible in a lot of places it's not accessible now. So let me tell you something else that's really cool about the gas turbine. Let's say you're next to a body of salt water where, okay, you have a ton of water, but it's not fresh water. You can use the salt water to cool that gas and at the same time generate desalinated water. With today's reactors, you can't use the waste heat for desalinization. You can consume some of your electricity you've produced to run a reverse osmosis system or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you can't use waste heat for it. And using waste heat would be really attractive because we have a lot of it. You know, today's reactors, two-thirds of the thermal energy they generate is rejected as waste heat. In the lifter, it would be a lot less. It would only be about half of the thermal energy generated would be rejected as waste heat. And that waste heat, if you were next to a body of salt water, could be used to desalinate water. So I think that in the longer run, I mean, we talk about what are the great resources? Well, they're energy and water. You know, you've got to have those two, probably not even that order, probably water and energy is the proper order for those two things. And this is a machine that can make both of them from this very abundant, very low-cost thorium fuel once it's been started.
Now, you mentioned that the Chinese were interested in that desalinization aspect of this technology. Overall, how would you gauge their hopefulness for getting this technology up and running and right?
Well, the guy who's giving the presentation was your quintessential engineer. You know, mm-hmm. He was betraying no emotion, and on top of that of his... I don't want to criticize his English because it's a whole lot better than my Chinese. Uh-huh. But let's just say he didn't wax expressive about the possibilities like I am prone to do. But it was clear in his presentation that desal and high-temperature fuel production and remote location and, you know, low-water environments, all of those were very much on their radar and very strong drivers for their investment in this technology, which right now is on the order, you know, I've heard on the order of about $400 million a year they're putting into this, which, you know, from my perspective, is just an enormous amount of money. You know, but from the perspective of governments, it's chump change. You know, we waste more money than that before we'll finish this conversation today.
Absolutely. And maybe they'll just prop the stock market up for 10 minutes or whatever they do with the money these days. So let's talk about your own efforts then. So here you are, you're in the United States, the actual discoverer of this technology. You've got a company just out there trying to drum up support for this. How's it going?
It's actually going really well. We've signed a contract with an engineering firm here in Huntsville to support work they're doing with a large utility here in the southern U.S. So we're funded to work and develop this technology. I mean, it's not an enormous amount of funding, but you know, it's good to be getting paid to do what you want to do anyway. So we're moving forward. We're making friends. We're getting this technology information out to all the right people, people who could really build and develop these kind of reactors. And I'm just couldn't be happier about where we are right now. No government involvement. You know, this is all being done with private funds, all being done with both companies and utilities. But it's all the right people you want to be working with. These are companies that have experience building and operating nuclear reactors. So it's not theoretical for them. It's something that they understand and they realize what they're getting into. And so it gives me a great deal of comfort when I'm showing designs to people who have all this nuclear experience and they're nodding their head going, oh, I didn't realize your technology could do things like that. You know, we'd kill or die to be able to do that kind of stuff right now with our existing plants.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. So this is actually a really important story, and I really do hope that our country wakes up and gets out of its little sleepwalking act and decides to get serious about all this. If people want to find out more about this and your work, where would they go?
I always send you to the website. I have to admit, though, it's getting a little long in the tooth. I'm the one that keeps it up, and I'm just so busy working on these efforts with the companies and the utilities that I have to admit I'm not keeping it up as good as I should. Another great resource is a fellow named Gordon McDowell. He's a Canadian filmmaker, and he's just been a great help in getting talks, particularly ones that I've done at different conferences out there on the web. On YouTube. So I Google Gordon McDowell YouTube, another great resource. I do try to keep up on the Flybe Energy. That's fly-energy.com. I do try to keep up the media page, which has links to articles, presentations, podcasts. I'm sure I will put this one on there just like other ones we've done. And that's good for people. I find people really like videos, podcasts. You know, they like to be able to watch or listen to things on the go. Mm-hmm. So all those resources are there for that. And email me if you have questions, KirkFSorensen@gmail.com, and I'll try to answer them if I have the time. I can't promise much, though.
All right. Well, Kirk, I love your energy, love your passion, love the vision and all of this. I'm actually really hoping that my country takes a run at this. And Europe hopefully is going to take a harder look at this too, because it's really clear where we are in this energy story. It's astonishing to me the data points that just continue to flood in, whether it's declining output from the oil majors who are spending more than they've ever spent to get that declining output. When we look at where we really are in the coal story and the grades of coal that we're burning and the environmental effects of all of that, there's just so much that says, listen, we need something new here. And to the people who keep, you know, telling me that, oh, we're going to alternative energy our way to this, I just, you know, a pencil in a napkin is sufficient to go, look, no matter how fast we grow our wind and our solar at this point, when we're talking quadrillions of BTUs, you have to have something that can really start to bite into that. And it's clear that we're not going to me anyway, that we're not going to alt energy our way to anything but a fairly disruptive sort of an approach. So with that, thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for all your efforts to keep this live and hopefully rejuvenated.
Thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk today.